Hello, this is Book Club Cheats, a podcast for book lovers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Lippy Turner-Roman, and today we're going to be talking about Kate Quinn's Rose Code. Last month, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, husband of Queen Elizabeth II, died. He was 99 years old, lived a jolly good long life, I would say. Growing up in England, the royal family was and is still a big part of everyday life for me and countless others. The Queen is the longest reigning monarch. The tabloids and reputable newsprint always seem to have a member of the royal household splashed across their pages. The royals are good business, both for the UK and for newspapers, full of intrigue, romance, sex, gossip, and sometimes flops. Kate Quinn's The Rose Code features all of these elements and Prince Philip as a character. He's the boyfriend of one of the protagonists, Ostler Kendall. I was intrigued how Quinn would fictionalize a person who had had such a very well-known life and strongly known character traits. I remember as a young girl watching news reports with Prince Philip forthrightly speaking his mind and making quite a few diplomatic gaffes. How would Quinn make Prince Philip sympathetic and likable for me was one of the reasons I picked up The Rose Code. The other, I gave my mother-in-law Quinn's previous book as a Christmas present last year, The Alice Network, and Mom raved about it. I knew I wanted to read her latest. The Rose Code explores the work of the once very secretive Bletchley Park, or BP. It was so secretive that acknowledgement of the park and what took place there during World War II only began to filter out to the public in the 1970s. Bletchley Park was a former stately home, which was bought by the head of MI6 and became the centre of the British and Allied code-breaking effort during the World War II. The work carried out at Bletchley fell under the Official Secrets Act. Divulging your work to co-workers, family or friends could get you jailed or killed. Even after the war, workers could not tell family or friends what they had done during the war at Bletchley, or even that they had worked there. Essentially, Bletchley Park was a code and cipher school. Personnel were recruited from British universities. MI6 also ran covert puzzles in newspapers to find expert code and cryptologists. Bletchley Park, or BP as affectionately known among the staff, ended up having an eclectic mix of scientists and high society young men and women, boffins and debs, working side by side. The work of these men and women reportedly cut short World War II by 2 to 4 years. In addition to Prince Philip, many of the characters in The Rose Code are based on real people. Some characters, according to Quinn in her author notes, are lightly fictionalized, like Ostler Kendall, and some are not. We meet Alan Turing, Ian Fleming, yes, the same guy that wrote James Bond, Winston Churchill, and Dilly Knox, all real people who worked or visited Bletchley Park. In terms of genre, The Rose Code is historical fiction. It takes place during World War II, 1939 to 1944, and the period just after it, well, actually, the 11 days in November in 1947, leading up to the wedding of Prince Philip and Princess Elizabeth. The chapters jump between these two periods. The story has friendship, loyalty, romance, loss and redemption, treason, espionage, suspense, tragedy, and dysfunctional families. Gosh, it's got a lot packed in. And since this book is 624 pages long, it's got enough real estate to fit in all of these themes and numerous plot devices. The book is written in third person, has triple storylines, and has alternative points of view. The Rose Code tells the story of three very different women, Ostler, Beth, and Mab, who, despite their disparate socioeconomic and temperamental backgrounds, find themselves working at Bletchley Park, becoming friends, then bitter enemies, and unmasking a traitor. The book opens in 1947. Ostler Kendall works for Tatler and is covering the royal wedding. It's a tad problematic for Ostler, since she is the longtime girlfriend of Prince Philip during the war, and it seems as the whole world is watching her reaction to her prince getting married to Britain's princess. To dampen everyone's pity, Ostler gets herself engaged to a longtime friend. We don't know who that friend is. She's not romantic about her upcoming marriage. She knows her fiancé is seeing other women. Ostler and Mab, a homemaker, get a cipher from Beth, who is currently locked up in Clockwell Sanatorium. The coded message tells Osler and Mab there was a traitor at Bletchley Park and they owe her. In 1939, Osler Kendall and Mab Chert meet on the train going to their new jobs at Bletchley Park. Osler deftly puts down a man masturbating in their compartment. Even though the two women are as different as night and day, they like each other immediately. Osler is a rich Canadian debutante with a socialite mother who is quickly going through husbands. Osler's godfather is Lord Louis Mountbatten, Prince Philip's uncle. Osler is charming and all about fun. However, she's also intelligent, has a serious side, and wants to make a difference and an impact. Osler uses her frivolity to stop people getting too close to her. Mountbatten and Sally Norton, another goddaughter of Mountbatten, introduces Osler to Prince Philip. Philip and Osler fall for each other immediately and start a lively, flirtatious relationship. Coming from broken homes, both Philip and Osler are in search of stable relationships and family. Philip gives Osler his Navy insignia, which I think means that they're going steady before he ships out. Philip and Osler promise to write to each other. Philip lets slip that his cousin Princess Elizabeth, or Lilibet, is also writing to him. Scrappy Mabel, or Mab, grows up poor in Shoreditch. She has a much younger sister, Lucy, whom Mab adores. Mab wants more than what her mother has, is ambitious and is determined to methodically improve herself and catch a good husband. Mab goes to secretarial school and is slowly but surely working herself through the list of 100 classic literary works for the well-read lady. At Bletchley, the women are debriefed by Commander Denniston, page 41. He continued, "The work here is so secret, you will be told only what is necessary for you to know, and you will never seek to find out more. Besides respecting internal security, you will be mindful of external security. You will never mention the name of this place, not to your family or friends. You will find that your colleagues refer it to as BP, and you will do the same. Above all, you will never disclose to anyone the nature of the work that you do here. To reveal the least hint might jeopardize the whole progress of the war." Another pause. "Are they training us to be spies?" Mab wondered, astonished. "Should anyone ask, you are doing ordinary clerical work. Make it sound dull. The duller, the better." Osler piped up. "What work will we be doing, sir?" "Good God, girl, have you listened to a single word I've said?" Impatience crept into Denniston's voice. "I don't know what you will be doing in any specific way, and I don't want to know." He opened a desk drawer and took out two sheets of yellowish paper, laying one in front of each of them. "This is the Official Secrets Act. It clearly states if you do any of the things I have warned you against, if you disclose the slightest information which could be of use to the enemy, you will be guilty of treason." The silence was absolute. "And treason," Commander Denniston finished mildly, "makes you liable to the most extreme penalties of the law. I am not sure at the moment whether that's hanging or firing squad." It couldn't get any quieter, but Mab felt the silence congeal. She took a deep breath. "Sir, are we allowed to refuse this post?" He looked startled. "There's no pistol to your head. This isn't Berlin. Refuse, and you will simply be ushered off the premises with strict instructions never to mention this place again." "And I'll never know what's really going on here," Mab thought. He laid two pens before them. "Sign, please, or not." Mab took another breath and signed across the bottom. She saw Ulster doing the same. "Welcome to BP," Commander Denniston said, with the first smile of the exchange. Just like that, the interview was over. Giles Talbot, still with his damp shirt tails flapping, steered them out into the hall. Osler gripped Mab's hand once the door shut behind them, and Mab wasn't too proud to grip back. "Wouldn't take it too seriously if I were you." Incredibly, Giles was chuckling. "That speech is a knee weakener the first time you hear it. Denniston was out when it was my turn, and I got the whole harangue from a wing commander who pulled a pistol out of his drawer and said he'd shoot me if I broke the sacred secrecy of etc., etc., etc. But you get used to it. Come along, let's get your billets sorted." Mab halted at the staircase, holding her arms. "Look here, Can't we get a hint now about what this place actually does? Isn't it obvious? He looked surprised. GC and CS. We call it Golf, Cheese and Chess Society because the place is packed with Oxford Dons and Cambridge Chess Champions, but it stands for Government Code and Cipher School. Mab and Osler must have looked baffled because he grinned. We're breaking German codes. Mab and Osler room at the Finch home. Mrs. Finch is a manipulative, mean, nosy, nasty bully of a woman. She keeps her 24-year-old daughter Beth infantilized and tied to her. Even though Beth has a photographic memory and can finish the crossword faster than most people can, Mrs. Finch has Beth and the whole village convinced that Beth is slow and intellectually challenged. Mrs. Finch also uses the Bible as a literal weapon, making Beth hold it up at arm's length for long periods as punishment. Crumbs, sure really is a nasty piece of work. Mab and Osler take Beth to BP, where she soon gets a job with the head of the cryptologist, Dilly Knox. Dilly is a sweet, absent-minded genius who has built a code-breaking unit made up entirely of women. The unit is affectionately called Dilly's Fillies. Beth becomes one of the best code-breakers in the unit and grows vastly in confidence. At BP, the women encounter a diverse group of people. Charming, smiling, ever-present Giles Talbot is friends with everyone and seems to be in love with someone's best friend always. Then there's Harry Zarb, a brilliant and intense academic. Harry is of Arab, Maltese, and Egyptian heritage. Harry's rich banking family cut him off after he gets barmaid Sheila pregnant and married her. Harry and Sheila dote on their young son, who wears a brace due to polio. Derogatory racial terms are frequently thrown about at Harry, both in the village and at Bletchley Park. Mab, Osler, Giles, Harry, Valerie and Mary Glassborough form a book club, the Mad Hatters, to socialise and let off steam. The three friends work in different chains of the code-breaking operation, which take place in wooden huts constructed on the grounds of BP. Initially, Osler and Mab get placed in the secretarial and grunt section, but due to Mab's height, she soon finds herself manning the bomb machines. These machines help decipher the daily settings of the Enigma machines and help break the codes. It's a hot, sweaty, and noisy job. Osler, who knows German and Italian, is moved to the translation hut, and Beth breaks the codes. Mab meets Francis Gray after he nearly runs her over one night. Francis works for the War Office, doing Lord knows what. He's never home, going here, going there. He totally reminded me of the Scarlet Pimpernel. Introverted and introspective, Francis is quite a bit older than Mab. 16-year-old Francis lied to enlist in World War I and returned home from the war profoundly changed. Francis is the author of a famous book of war poetry that the Mad Hatters are reading. Mab lets Francis know that she hates the poems. Francis asks Mab out to dinner for a curry. Poor Mab has no idea what a curry is and spends the evening pushing the orange food around the plate whilst trying to get Francis to engage in full sentences. I cook a lot of mean curries and none of them are orange, so Mab has my sympathies. Osler goes up to London for a night out on the town. The nightclub she's dancing in gets bombed. It's pretty horrific. Shocked to see her dance partner and countless others dead, Osler is dazed and confused, and she's horrified to see people looting the bodies. She's helped by a good Samaritan, a soldier who gives her his coat. Osler will wear his coat for the rest of the war and beyond. Osler tracks down his address from the initials inside the coat and begins to write to him. Her letters to her Samaritan are different, not as upbeat as the ones that she writes to Philip. Osler never gets a reply back from her Samaritan. Beth breaks the Italian code, and this allows the British to foil a major attack in the Mediterranean. Winston Churchill comes to visit Bletchley to thank the workers and motivate them. Francis, who comes along with Churchill, asks Mab to marry him, and Mab bemusedly accepts. Beth, exhilarated by her success, picks up a stray dog and takes him home. She defies her mother by keeping the dog. However, one day, Mrs. Finch purposely keeps the dog in, making him soil the carpets so she can kick the dog out. This enrages Beth, who tells her mother all the things she's kept inside. Beth, Mab and Osla walk out of the Finch house and get new accommodations. Beth is attracted to Harry Zarb. However, Beth can't get over the fact that Harry's married. Beth runs into Harry's wife, Sheila, who tells her that the marriage is not what everyone thinks it is. Both Sheila and Harry stay married for their son. Sheila has a lover and gives her blessing for Beth to start a relationship with Harry. Harry and Beth go up to Cambridge and make love. Mab and Francis have a quick register wedding in London. Osler and the staff at Claridge's help out putting the wedding together. Lucy attends the wedding in clothes borrowed from her unsuspecting Claridge guest. At her wedding night, Mab discovers Francis is an insomniac because of his war experience. During a quick honeymoon in the Lake District, Mab and Francis become close and discover the way to communicate is through letters and lovemaking. While Francis is not physically verbal, he's very verbose and effervescent in the written word. Francis and Mab pour out their deepest feelings and thoughts to one another in notes and letters, even when they're in the same space together. Francis knows Mab is keeping secrets, and Mab, seduced by Francis's gentleness and goodness, writes her shameful secret down. Mab was deceived by a student at Cambridge, believing he'd marry her, only to find out he's just having fun with the slut from Shoreditch. He brought all his friends around to share Mab. Mab refuses to tell Francis her ultimate secret, but he guesses that Lucy is Mab's daughter. Francis wants Lucy to live with them after the war. Mab cannot believe how good Francis is to her. Lord, I was half in love with Francis myself here. Dilly Knox is dying and leaves BP. He gets permission to take work home with him. Beth visits Dilly and he tells her he's working on a Russian rose code. After Dilly's death, Beth discovers the rose code in the material Dilly was working on. She doesn't give it much importance and drops it in the to-be-look basket at BP. She later regrets not paying more attention to this code. Beth begins to work on Dilly's Russian code and deduces that someone at BP has been giving classified information to the Russians. Beth hasn't cracked the full code, so she has no idea who the traitor is or how to prove it. Beth deposits the partially deciphered code into Dilly's home safe. Osla, meanwhile, is convinced someone is going to different huts and rummaging through the reports looking for things and taking things. She has no concrete evidence and knows that MI6 will not believe her. Philip and Osla meet during one of his visits home. They are stuck at the station along with hundreds of other travellers when the lights go out. Philip and Osla kiss a lot, and Philip tells Osla his sad family history, his parents fleeing their home, his mother's descent into mental imbalance, tales of his beloved sister's marriages to Nazis, and his time at boarding school. However, the new administration at BP and MI6 tell Osla to break off her romance with Philip. They suspect his loyalty to Britain and think Osla may be tempted to give him secrets. MI6 threaten Philip's career. Loving Philip, Osla stops writing to him. She gives him up for his own good. Francis wants Mab and Lucy to visit his home in Coventry to see the large house Mab will be mistress of after the war. Mab invites Beth, but Beth has to work, so Osla decides to tag along instead. Beth deciphers a code which tells the British that the Germans will bomb the city of Coventry that weekend. Beth decides not to tell her friends. She justifies withholding this incredible information by telling herself the Official Secret Act forbids it. In Coventry, Francis gives Lucy riding boots, which cement the little girl's and Mab's love for him. Mab cannot believe how lucky she is. Okay, spoilers ahead, but I think many of you will have guessed what's coming, and it's not good. The rays start in Coventry in the night. Osla scoops up a sleeping Lucy in her arms and runs out. Francis and Mab follow. However, a disorientated Lucy lets go of Osla's hand and runs back to Francis's house for her beloved riding boots. Francis goes after Lucy. As Francis steps out of his house, Lucy in his arms, the bombed-out walls of the house next door come crashing down on Lucy and Francis. Mab goes crazy and blames Osla for letting go of Lucy's hand. Osla also blames herself. Okay, I was a big sorry mess here. My heart was just so sad about Francis and Lucy. Mab has a mental and physical breakdown. The only way to get through her pain and grief is through alcohol. Mab can't stand to be near Osler and moves to a different room. Mab expresses her churned up feelings of loss to an interviewer doing a story on Francis's poetry. Page 426. You want a personal anecdote, Mr. Graham? She took a second drink, turning to the journalist. The truth is, I don't have any. Francis Gray was the best man I've ever known, and I was his wife less than 1 year. You know how many times we saw each other? 14. He was always travelling, and I had a job we agreed was important, so we did our best. We had 48-hour wedding and honeymoon. We had 2 weekends in the Lake District. We had the odd meal in a railway cafe, made love a total of 15 times. She didn't care if she was being indecent. She didn't care if she was saying it to a journalist. She had to say it to someone after thinking it so many nights or she would burst. Ian Graham listened without interrupting, and that was all that mattered. We loved each other by proxy, Mr. Graham. He loved me through a girl he saw once in Paris in 1918, and I loved him through his letters, but we hardly spent any time together. I don't have any personal anecdotes about my husband. We don't have any time to create any. Her voice cracked. She bolted down the gin. I know he liked curry and dawn walks. I know he hated his own poetry and never slept the night through because of the things he saw in the trenches. But I didn't know him. You have to live with someone to know them. I've lived with my billet mates for 3.5 years. I know them inside and out. I loved Francis Gray, and to me he was perfect. And that's the proof. I didn't know him very well. I never got to realize all the ways he wasn't perfect. I didn't get to reach the point where the song he whistled while shaving drove me mad, or listen or learn how rainy days made him short-tempered. He never got to realize that I'm not some great wartime love, just a shallow cow who lives for pretty shoes and library novels. We never got round to quarrelling over the milk bill or whether to buy strawberry jam or marmalade. It was the thing that killed Marb every night. When she grieved for Lucy, she grieved for the woman her daughter would never become. The young girl taking her exams, the cultish student heading off to university. But at least she had known the 6-year-old Lucy of November 1942 to her very bones. So much of Francis had still been an unmapped continent, a man she could only begin to know. And he didn't know me, she thought, or he wouldn't have loved me the way he did. He would have realized I was a social climbing tot who'd marry a good man like him as a ticket up the ladder. He would have realized he deserved better than me. I don't have one single photograph of the two of us together. Mab stared into her glass. Not one. We couldn't get a camera on our wedding day. It was a short notice, and after that we were too busy cramming in time together to pose for a flash. An entire marriage gone without one picture to commemorate it. She looked at the journalist's grave face. There's something titillating for your story, she said, mocking. Francis Gray's drunken Shoreditch widow slopping gin all over you in a pub. I don't care if you print it. I don't care what you say about me. I'm a journalist, not a monster, said Ian Graham. But I do care what you say about Francis. Do justice to him. He was a good poet and a good man. She finished her gin in a gulp. Is there anything I can do to help? The journalist asked, his voice quiet. On New Year's Eve, Osler goes up to London and bumps into Philip at Claridge's. Philip has the flu, and he really wants to get better because he needs to attend a pantomime put on by Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret the next day. Osler nurses him through the night, and they talk, and there's some heavy petting going on there. Philip wonders why she stopped writing to him. He says Lilibet never stopped writing to him. Beth doesn't see or does not want to see what's going on with her friends. Beth tries to convince herself that she did the right thing, not telling her friends that Coventry would be bombed when they were visiting it. She rationalizes her choices to herself. What are the odds her friends will find out the truth? However, Peggy, another of Dilly's fillies, tells Mab that Beth decoded the message that Coventry would be bombed. Peggy is surprised. Beth hadn't told her friends to stay away. A shell-shocked and furious Mab tackles Beth at home in front of Osler. Marb accuses Beth of asking her friends to break their oaths to help Beth out, but has never had any intention of returning the favour for her friends. Beth comes totally unglued, completely breaks down in front of her friends, falling on the ground and having a hysterical fit. disgusted Mab and Osler leave. MI6 arrives, sedate Beth, and take her to Clockwell Sanatorium. When Osler comes back home, Beth's side of the room is cleared out, and Mab has transferred to London. That was the last time the women talked to one another or saw one another until 1947. Beth spends 3 years in Clockwell Sanatorium, where the real traitor sent her to stop her revealing their secrets. Beth is still not sure who the traitor is. Clockwell is awful. The staff are borderline sadistic. The residents are sedated most of the time. Beth is routinely in a straitjacket, force-fed and medicated. The traitor is making sure that the medical staff perform a lobotomy on Beth. She doesn't know what there is and gives a creepy orderly a blowjob to find out. When Beth's mother is out of town, her father screws up the courage to visit Beth for the first time. She uses emotional blackmail to get him to deliver the coded messages to Osler and Mab. Beth has convinced herself that the traitor is Peggy. When Giles, now in MI6, shows up at Clockwell and tells her he's the traitor. Actually, Giles believes he's a patriot, that Britain should have been sharing its secrets with its then ally Russia all along. Giles wants the rest of the code, and if Beth doesn't give it to him by the royal wedding, he'll have Beth lobotomized. Osler and Mab have a chilly and bitchy reunion in Yorkshire. They decide to see Beth. Mab is married to an Australian former aviator who was wounded during the war. She married him after deciding she wanted a baby and thought Mike would serve as well as anyone. Mike and Mab have a lovely pair of twins, Eddie and Lucy. Mab is loving to her children, but her heart and emotions are still encased with Francis. Frustrated and angry, Mike tries to understand Mab, but Mab doesn't want to talk. Osler and Mab turn up at the asylum and, like everyone else, are shocked by Beth's emancipated and unkempt appearance. Beth tells them it's their duty to help prove Giles is a traitor. Osler then smoothly informs all of us that Giles is her fiancé, but not for much longer. Wow, I actually didn't see that coming. Very Thackeray and Becky Sharpish there. Beth breaks out of Clockwell with Mab and Osler's help, and the trio make their way to Dilly's home to retrieve the code in his safe. Beth tries to break the code, but she realises she needs help, and so the Mad Hatters come to help. Harry, Valerie, Glassborough, Middleton and Peggy arrive at the now deserted BP. Peggy works for MI6 now and gets a bomb machine to help crack the code. To Mab's surprise, Mike arrives to service the machine. I guess after getting shot down over England, Mike actually worked at BP servicing the bomb machines. Crazy or what, Mike and Mab worked at BP at the same time, not knowing one another. Mab finds a new appreciation in Mike, and whilst Mike tells Mab he would like to know about Francis. Osler gets to go to lunch with Princesses Elizabeth and Margaret at Buckingham Palace. It's a PR exercise so the gossips can stop talking. Philip is not there. Princess Margaret asks Osler if Philip is up to the job of supporting her sister and the royal family, and Osler tells her yes, that's all Philip has ever wanted, a family. Philip later tells Osler he'll help her always. Beth solves the Rose Code, which verifies that Giles is a spy for the Russians. Beth, Osler, Mab, Harry and Mike head up to London. Osler's a guest at the royal wedding and she tells Giles to come collect her from the hotel, but Giles already knows that Beth has escaped and makes a run for it. The group chase him down to a railway station where they jump him. Giles and his pursuers are all thrown in jail by the police, who don't know what to think. Since Osler is wearing her Good Samaritan coat, the police ring him, Major John Percival Edwin Charles Cornwall, and lo and behold, he turns up. He tells Osler he was posted all over the world and always received her letters. Osler phones Philip on his wedding day to get them out of jail. The three-part at the train station. Page 620. They stood in the softly falling snow, putting off the moment of departure. Osler returning to London, Beth thought, me to Cambridge, Mab all the way back to York. Despite Osler's talk of family, what are the chances they'd ever meet up again without the work of Bletchley Park to draw them together? The three of them had nothing in common besides BP. In a normal course of life, they would have never crossed paths at all. Thank you, Beth blurted, both of you, breaking me out of the asylum, hiding me. It had to be said. They had to be thanked.
What if she never got the chance after today? I don't need thanks. Mab took a long last drag of a cigarette. Duty, honor, oaths. They're not just for soldiers, not just for men. I want to thank you anyway. Beth took a deep breath, eyes blurring. And I'm sorry. Coventry, not warning you. She couldn't hold their eyes. She looked away, back towards Bletchley Park. Bloody hell, Beth. Mab dropped her cigarette, grinding it under one high-heeled boot. There are things I don't want to forgive you for, you or O, that maybe I won't ever able to completely. But that doesn't mean we don't... She stopped, looked up, brows slanted at their most ferocious angle. The rushed three-way hug was fierce, spiky, awkward. Beth felt the silkiness of Osler's mink against her cheek, inhaled Mab's familiar perfume. Look, Mab scowled as they pulled apart. Trains run all the way to York. Don't be strangers, you two. We could pick a book. Start up the Mad Hatters again, Osler swiped her eyes. Meet at Betty's, have a tea party with actual scone and jams. Beth pushed her wave of hair behind her one ear. I've been reading the Principia Mathematica. She found Isaac Newton flat going, but sometimes she caught a glimpse of intriguing spirals around the edges of the complicated exercises Harry showed her. Spirals of numbers rather than letters. Oh, darling, don't make us do math, Osler groaned. What about the Road to Oz? I've been devouring bomb. Too fantastical, Mab complained. There's a new Hercule Poirot coming out. We never did agree about book, Osler said. Never agreed about anything, Mab snorted and checked her watch. I'm going to miss my train. A final nod, and then Beth stood before the gates with boots waffling about the frozen ground, watching the ivory coat and the jade green coat swing up the road. Osler, she suddenly called, almost shouting, Mab! They turned in unison. These two smart brunettes who had stalked with such style into the Finch kitchen and into Beth's life in 1940. Beth filled her lungs. These have knelled your fall and ruin, Osler caught on first. But your ears were far away. Mab picked it up. English lassies rustling papers. They finished in a triumphant shout. Through the sodden Bletchley day. And for the last time in decades, Bletchley Park resounded with the laughter of coat bakers. Here are some book club questions. At Bletchley Park, women worked side by side with men. They were equals. How do you think they felt returning to their former lives as homemakers after the war? Do you think Beth, Mab and Osler would have become friends if they had met elsewhere at another time? Beth decides she doesn't want to get married, wants to keep working for MI6 and carry on her relationship with a married Harry. How does this buck the cultural and historical expectations of women for the period? Beth, Mab and Osler's friendship breaks down. Have you ever had a close friendship breakdown? How did you repair it? Did you want to repair it? Should some friendships just be let go? Mab says duty, honour, oaths are not just for soldiers or men. What do you think? I really enjoyed The Rose Code. I hope you get to read it soon. Other books by Kate Quinn are The Huntress and The Alice Network, which I'll be swiping from my mother-in-law pretty soon. Goodbye! The epilogue recounts the actual reopening of Bletchley Park after restoration in 2014 by Valerie Glassborough's Middleton's granddaughter, the Duchess of Cambridge, the former Kate Middleton. The Duchess meets Mab Sharp and all of her very tall children and grandchildren, and Beth Finch, who continued working for the government, still dedicated to her oath of secrecy. And Osler married her Good Samaritan, wrote a droll book about her work at Bletchley, which was published after her death in 1974. I really enjoyed The Rose Code. It took me 3 days to finish the book. As I noted above, it's a fairly long book, over 600 pages, with a large cast of characters. The chapters are quite short, so there's lots of them. You can put the book down and it's easy to pick up the story. Quinn's writing is fairly engaging and easy to read and moved quickly for me. The story, however, does take some time to pick up speed and so may lag or feel slow for some readers. After about page 180, the narrative moves quite quickly. Quinn lets the reader know the three women, showing the women spending time together, building their friendship, and it makes sense when their friendships blossom. We spend a lot of time in the minds of these three women. Quinn also takes the same approach, building and layering the story of the lovely romance between Mab and Francis. I actually enjoyed the portions with Prince Philip. It was a little hard at first. I'm sorry, I just kept seeing Prince Philip as I had known him growing up in the 80s. Then Quinn's writing worked its magic and I began to see Philip as Matt Smith from The Crown, so all good. Also, perhaps knowing this was a real person whose end story I knew spoiled the romance between Philip and Osla for me. I appreciated Quinn's focus on the women that worked at Bletchley to finally have a fuller picture of the huge contribution women made breaking codes and ultimately shortening the war and defeating Hitler was exhilarating to read. I also really, really appreciated the characterization of the women. They were all smart, independent, and had a great strength of spirit. The book is really well researched. I loved reading the behind-the-scenes work of all the hundreds of women and men and the dedication and sacrifices needed to work at Bletchley. These people didn't get a medal or an acknowledgement until very recently. Many of them were looked down for not fighting. Quinn includes a lot of atmospheric detail about BP and the work conducted there. She gives precise details about the whole intricate process of code breaking and its analysis, showing how the actual code breaking work was actually tedious, mind-numbing and exhausting rather than the quick and sexy and easy representation we've seen in movies. Reading about the 16-hour workdays and around-the-clock shifts sure exhausted me thinking about them. The book doesn't really have much diversity or representation. Pretty much everyone is white except Harry, and we do hear about a gay gentleman. Maybe that's my little quibble. Maybe this lack of diversity was the actual situation in Bletchley, something for me to research. Quinn does do a good job of representing the historical period with her use of language, including the racist and sexist language prevalent during the time. Quinn also uses Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll as a motif in the story. Beth is known as Alice Liddon in Cockwell. The book club is called Mad Hatters, and being at Bletchley is referred to falling down the rabbit hole. The book has some suspense, but Quinn doesn't really do much with it. We and Beth know that there's a traitor, and rather than build up that suspense, Giles just sort of shows up and says, "Yeah, it's me. I'm the traitor." It seems out of character and just puffed the air out of the story. Additionally, the war years were leisurely and the ending felt very, very rushed.